This is the Education Gadfly Show.
New Orleans is, you know, is a big success. Absolutely.
Rick, do you give a damn about education policy?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Howard Stern of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
I'm pretty sure that in our 4 years on the air, 5 years, 6 years, what is it, Joe?
Six.
6 years on the air, I've used that one before. But I mentioned Howard Stern because we, as we'll learn later today, we have a new science standards report out at Fordham, and it was picked up on the Howard Stern Show.
So did Howard Stern make some off-color joke about it, or was it Robin Quivers?
It was Robin supposedly reporting this as a part of her news roundup, and we're not sure yet what kind of back and forth it might have been, but we're trying to find out. We are trying to find the tape right now. But it is on his website, a link to a reference to it. And we did hear from the brother-in-law of one of our staff members that he mentioned the report on the air.
Because I'm curious, right? I mean, the dream scenario for you guys is that he gets Howard Stern gets a couple of, eye candy girls in there, and they do some kind of striptease-ish game to, like, your evaluation of science standards, like how to New Mexico rate. Or where did Oklahoma? That way you guys are actually getting picked up on multi-platforms.
Well, you know, we have been aiming for a younger demographic here, and I think this will help. Now, in terms of the very young demographic, we have a really cool dinosaur and a volcano in the cover, and we think this is going to be very popular among the preschool set.
Yeah. Yeah, if not them, at least all those middle schoolers are eager to read think tank analyses of academic standards.
Exactly. All right. Well, it's good to have you back, Rick. Is this 2 weeks in a row?
I believe it is.
I cannot believe it. You're like, well, have you been grounded or something? Are you not flying around?
I got to say, my February schedule is awesome. I think I'm only on the road like two, three nights in February. I am so excited.
Yeah, and those are probably in Vegas.
Vegas, baby. Vegas.
All right, let's get started. Ty, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
This week, the Fordham Institute released its review of state science standards, and the findings were dismal. The majority of states rated a D or F. What can states do to turn this mess around?
It's not hard, Ty. They can just take the standards of the leading states like California and use them as their own. In fact, that's what the District of Columbia has done. D.C. has now scored quite well in our latest reviews of standards across the board, because a few years ago, they said they need new standards. They went out and they basically just copied those of the leading states. And now they've got those in their tests. And look, it's a little too soon to tell what's happening in D.C., but you could argue that some of the improvements we've seen in D.C. recently have started with having strong academic standards at the base.
So your whole convoluted, expensive state standards evaluation process is basically just an inducement for states to go cut and paste, and that is going to drive science achievement and science learning in their state.
It's a good place to start, yes. Now, if they don't want to do that, they can also sign on to the effort by ACHIEVE and 26 states to develop common standards in science. This is sort of like the Common Core of science. We expect to see drafts out in April, and we're hoping, fingers crossed, that they'll be pretty good. But now we'll have a way to tell states, well, yours are better or they are worse than what the common standards have. And you know, Rick, look, if you look at these standards, the bad ones, the D's and F's, basically you say, look, these are not standards. I mean, they're so vague and vapid. They have these statements that are like, yeah, kids should learn chemistry. Next, it doesn't do anything to clarify for teachers what's expected to be learned. And yet, all of the states have to test in science under No Child Left Behind. So what that really means is that the states are just kicking it over to the test developers to decide what the real standards should be.
But it's, I guess I'm a little curious about, like, this is always what I find interesting about the logic of how standards are going to drive improved learning. So, all right, so the test developers are devising items and test banks, and and they're back mapping the instructional materials from that. So the teachers are teaching that. Mm-hmm. So why is it better to have a laundry list of what kids are supposed to learn rather than this de facto curriculum?
Yeah, I mean, because I think you want to have clarity. I mean, if you're a teacher teaching science and you're going to be held accountable for achievement based on a test, you know, you should be clear about what that content is going to be. And we should make sure that the content is good content and it's pitched at a high level, that we're not learning dinosaurs every year, that scientists have had a chance to weigh in and help develop this and make sure that it's rigorous.
But they haven't if you're just cutting and pasting standards from other places.
Yeah, but in those standards in other places involve scientists and got it right. So the point is, look, we don't need to do this 50 different times. there are some really good science standards out there, and states should look to use them. Topic number two.
The Department of Education recently sent letters to states that applied for NCLB waivers, scolding most of them for failing to do enough in the applications to ensure schools would be held accountable for student performance. Does this make you more optimistic about the waiver plan?
Oh my God, Rick, this makes me so angry. Okay, I think this is outrageous. Last year, the administration got three different times all this great press around their waiver plans, okay? Including just in September with the president making this big announcement about flexibility. Lo and behold, you get some leading states, many of them chiefs for change states, race to the top states, saying, here, we want to try some things differently, right? And the response back from the Department of Ed is a big N-O. Okay, what they're going to end up approving, I suspect, and I think we'll find out this week, are some minute little tweaks to AYP, not this widespread flexibility the president talks about. I think this could be a huge issue this year, maybe not in presidential politics, but you know, the Republicans can certainly make hay out of the fact that the administration is not following through with its promise for real flexibility.
Well, I like the scolding. I like the admonishments. I like writing these letters. I love the whole notion of the Department of Ed sitting up there and allowing each state to come in on bended knee and say, please, sir, please, here's what I... You know, it takes us all back to like 2002 with the implementation of the state plans under NCLB.
Yep, yep. No, it's here we are all over again. I mean, look, the main debate is at the heart of AYP. It's this question of what kind of accountability is there going to be for subgroups? So if the school doesn't make the grade for its kids with disabilities, does it get labeled as in need of improvement or not? Okay, that's what it comes down to. And the whole part of flexibility was to say, hey, maybe that's not the best way to do things. And so states have come up with some suggestions. For example, saying, look, we're going to look at subgroups. We're going to report all the data in subgroups. But when it comes to accountability, we're going to look overall at how kids are doing, and we'll have another subgroup that says for disadvantaged kids. We'll put all the minority kids and special ed and English language learners in there. Not a perfect solution, but it seems reasonable enough. That's the kind of thing that it appears the administration is saying no to under pressure by the Army of the Potomac here in Washington, the Ed Trust groups and others, who say we are not going to budge on this subgroup accountability piece.
Yeah. And I mean, think, you know, this is why some of us had really mixed feelings back in 2001 when the Bush administration, you know, cheerfully signed on to bean counting by race. Because once you get these kinds of distinctions written into law, it becomes, you know, much more complicated to try to get them back out. And rather than talk about our Title I dollars being used effectively to serve low-income kids, we're caught up in a whole bunch of identity and racial politics and everything else.
By the way, Rick, it seems like today I'm all fired up and angry, and you're Mr. Mellow over there.
I'm balancing you out, baby.
Wow. I'm a little nervous. Do we need to pep you up somehow?
We got the Super Bowl coming. I'm on an even keel about these other matters of state.
I see. But if we were debating the Pats and whether, for example, they can win without cheating, that's something that you might get excited about.
Oh, that's just, look at that.
Sorry, that was Ty's joke that I just borrowed there. Okay, Ty, number three.
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal is aiming high on education reform, looking to create the country's largest voucher program and toughest teacher accountability system. Will a rising political star get burned?
Okay, before we talk about the substance here, Rick, can we remind our listeners? Do you remember Stafford Palmieri came on the show as a research assistant here at Fordham?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, she is now Bobby Jindal's policy director, mm-hmm. writing these speeches, pushing these school choice proposals.
Get in the mix. I always say Fordham is the farm team for people out there doing the work. But look, this is one of one of these situations where I'm actually much less interested in whether he has a voucher proposal or a teacher quality proposal, and much more interested in what does it actually consist of. I mean, I think this is where we sometimes get in trouble, mm-hmm. is the headlines are you doing something bold around teacher evaluation or teacher pay, rather than are you doing something smart mm-hmm. around teacher evaluation or teacher pay?
Yeah, look, but I think the governor deserves a lot of credit for being smart on other issues. I mean, you look at the charter sector in New Orleans and all the nuance and care that's been taken to have that come out right.
I wouldn't argue that's really been much of a state level process. I mean, that's been driven by a lot of factors.
Right.
I mean, he's been. I think Jindal strikes me as a smart, competent guy, but just the way I think this was a Wall Street Journal editorial kind of enthusing about this, and I'm And I don't at least know enough about the details of what's in the proposal yet to be able to judge whether this is, you know, something that's exciting or not.
You know, speaking of New Orleans, by the way, I saw something the other day that looks like very soon the New Orleans student achievement is going to surpass the achievement of the rest of Louisiana, which is pretty remarkable. And again, it's, you know, you say how enthusiastic can we be about some reforms? Is it too soon to say that, you know, this has been a huge success, what's happened in New Orleans over the last 5 years?
Yeah, I think that's right.
It is too soon to tell her.
Oh, no. I think New Orleans is, you know, is a big success. Absolutely.
Rick, do you give a damn about education policy this week? So there's a Super Bowl. So what? Will you wake up Monday feeling different if the Pats win or lose? I mean, will that really shape the kind of Monday you're going to have next week?
No.
It doesn't really matter.
All right. But that's what's interesting about so many of our affinities in this world, right? I mean, not just professional sports, but also really, say, a presidential contest. I mean, the direct impact that'll have on your life, whether or not President Obama is elected or not, reelected or not, is really kind of limited. But we get enormously worked up about all kinds of these things, which have only, you know, a limited impact on our day-to-day lives.
Beautiful notion. Beautifully said. Good. Now it's good. If we lived in a dictatorship, we might feel differently.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thanks, Mike.
So do you agree with Rick here that it doesn't matter who gets elected? It doesn't change our life all that much?
It changes my life when it changes my taxes, because I feel like I'm paying enough in taxes right now, and I don't want to pay any more. I'd like to give my money who I want to give my money charitably and whatnot and so on.
Amber's a little upset about a big gas tax that's been proposed in Maryland, which I know, as someone who rides his bike to work and takes the bus, I'm not as sympathetic.
But it's not. But also, I mean, it's not like, right, a president or a governor unilaterally raises these things, right? I mean, there's other branches of government. Now, with our waiver process, for instance, we're seeing a fascinating interest in bypassing all the machinery of American government.
Can I say one more thing about this waiver? I mean, if this comes out that they say no to a bunch of these states because of their accountability system is so out of line, you know, because they want to do these crazy things, like, all right, what state is going to apply for a waiver? Because they're going to say, look, I'll get a smidgen of flexibility and we'll have to sign on to all these other conditions about stuff that has nothing to do with this.
I don't think this terribly concerns the Department of Education. I mean, why would that?
Well, it's not their problem. If they want states to have waivers. I mean,
why do they want states to have waivers?
Because the politics, that they'd be able to claim that they fixed No Child Left Behind. This is going to give new energy to reauthorization on the Hill, which will go nowhere. It's a mess. The city is so messed up. And we tax too much. That's Amber's view. Okay, Amber.
Anyway, Research Minute, well, that's what we're doing here today, right?
Sure.
New study out by MDRC that examines the impact of attending small public high schools on graduation rates, a randomized lottery-based study, MDRC, you get my point, compared roughly 21,000 lottery winners and losers who'd applied to 123 oversubscribed small non-selective high schools between 2002 and 2008. Roughly 100 students per grade in grades 9 through 12. It's a follow-up to one that was released last summer, which found positive impacts on graduation rates for lottery winners. New study looks at more cohorts in a nutshell, found that small schools increased average four-year graduation rates for the first two cohorts combined by about 8.6 percentage points. Small schools also substantially increased students' college readiness in English, which is basically measured by scores on Regents exam, and there's a cutoff, and SUNY basically uses that cutoff to exempt kids from taking remedial courses. So the kids in small schools did better on that measure. Subgroup analysis revealed that all these sort of graduation positive effects held for kids regardless of race, income, scores on math and reading tests. Bottom line, I mean, keep in mind these aren't charter schools. They're sort of schools that are run by the DOE, but they also had to go through this competitive proposal process. They're started from scratch, which is key. They're not like you take a large school and you break it down into a bunch of little sub-schools. They had to go through, they have to have demanding curriculum. They have to have personalized attention. I mean, there's all these different criteria. So bottom line, it's not just the size of the school that could be impacting what we're seeing. It could be a bunch of other stuff.
And Amber, how concerned should people be that, by definition, I mean, these schools are all oversubscribed?
How concerned would she be?
Well, I mean, the problem is that, right, if you have, you presume if you think parents, unless you think people are total dolts, you assume oversubscribed schools are oversubscribed for a reason.
Yeah, but I mean, they make a big point, and I'd be curious whether you guys know about this process they have by which students are, you know, they do 10 or 12 preferences, and then they kind of go through them, and they say, at least in the report, and I don't know enough about the assignment process in New York City to say, that the process sort of ameliorates some of that concern.
I mean, that a lot of schools are oversubscribed in a way because kids are choosing, have to list so many different schools.
Right.
It's a little hard to know in that system what it means to be oversubscribed.
That's right.
So one of the, you know, some critics have said, well, what this report doesn't look at special ed kids.
Yeah, and there's a couple sentences in there, again, that said, oh, they have some, I guess they initially they got some kind of waiver where they could kind of tinker with how many special ed kids they could, you know, admit. But then the little footnote in the report says, well, that's actually not true anymore. They took that, you know, away. So it's unclear to me, frankly, what's going on there.
You know, Jay Green had an interesting post this week, and he basically said, hey, this vindicates the old Gates Foundation strategy of breaking up smaller schools. They just didn't wait long enough, stick long enough with that strategy. That Tom Vander Ark was right all along, who used to be at Gates, that small schools do work. Is that a reasonable conclusion here?
No, I mean, it's just, you know, Amber pointed this out, right? That this is the old stone soup problem, right? You know the old parable that they're going door to door and they say, hey, we'll make great stone soup. All you've got to do, villagers, is give us a couple of carrots and a little bit of celery and some rabbits, and it turns out to be great soup. It's not great soup because of the stone. It's a great soup because of everything else that you've piled in there. Look, I mean, you know, what this tells us is that when you get to start clean slate schools with additional resources, with additional support, when you get to build, that you can wind up on average running schools that graduate high school or slightly more often than other schools. Even setting aside the oversubscription kind of question. This hardly strikes me as a newsflash. If you can't start a fresh fresh state school
and
on the rest of this and graduate, you know, 1 in 12 kids, you know, graduate kids at 1 in 12 higher rate than the other schools, I got to say, I'm not sure you, you know, have any business.
You want to know how much this evaluation cost?
Yeah.
$3.5 million.
That's astounding.
$3.5 million.
You know the people some explaining to do? Ooh. MDRC. I want to see how they build these cost structures. And who paid for this? Was this federal money? Or?
That would be Gates.
Wow. That is just astonishing.
I mean, that's what the Times reported. I actually was scouring because, you know, they don't like to put that in the evaluation. It wasn't. But according to them, that's what this evaluation cost.
Wow.
So, Amber, tell us what you got for a pop quiz this week.
So last week we asked what percentage of teachers under the age of 30 left the profession after the 08-09 year. 6, 8, 11, or 13%. What'd you say? I can't remember.
I didn't guess. I kept my mouth shut. I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Oh, all right. Well, you can guess now. What do you think?
13%.
Rick's not going to play. I know he's not. Correct answer is 11%.
I got to say, those numbers were so close to each other that it's...
Yeah. All right.
Kind of hard.
Are you critiquing the way Amber's doing her pop quizzes?
I know.
Yes.
He didn't like the song. He's not going to like the quiz. I don't know what I can do to please this person.
He just wants his pass.
This is why Amber didn't want me on her dissertation committee.
This is true.
A good move on that one.
Oh, boy, I would still be there. All right. How many states? So we're going to talk a little bit about our science report. So I'm going to pull a little poll this week from the science standards report, get our readers into it. How many states had science standards that were rated worse in 2012 than in 2005, the last time we rated science standards around here? Do we think that would be 3 states, 16, 20, or 24? Our listeners can cast their vote at edexcellence.net/podcast.
I love it. These are the states that looked at our report in 2005 and decided we're going to do the exact opposite of what Fordham is telling us to do. And we know those states are out there.
They're out there.
There's more than a few. And Amber, I would just suggest that on the B through D, we want more spread. That's all I'm saying.
So you can have a better chance of getting your answer right?
No, it's just so that we're over a larger terrain.
Yeah, all right, where do they go to place their answers?
edexcellence.net/podcast.
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that?
Welcome back, Chris.
Good to be here, Mike. How's it going?
Good. We've been doing a lot of Super Bowl talk here. Are you rooting for somebody?
I'm rooting for a good game. You know, I just want to enjoy the fourth quarter.
He's rooting for a good game, Rick.
That's you know, and we've had a lot more of those like in the last decade than you used to.
It's true. So, you know, statistically, we probably shouldn't get one, but
You know what it is? It used to be like you always used to get the Bills or the Broncos in the Super Bowl, and that guaranteed that the score was going to be like 49-14.
Yeah, it used to be all, you know, Cowboys, Niners, and that NFC Championship game.
That was the game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what do you got for us this week? I'm trying to play along here, and then the writer just goes right over my head. I think I've watched a few of those games.
Sure.
Yeah. Before I had kids.
Understandable.
Yeah, actually, very few fathers watch a Super Bowl with their kids.
Have you tried to get like a 2- and 4-year-old to sit still for 3 hours?
No.
Yeah.
Right. This is why I recommend Velcro.
By the way, is it true that the 4-year-old was running naked through your house the other night?
This is what I hear.
Yeah, you can get in trouble for that.
He was cute.
Yeah.
I think it went over big.
It was a big hit. Okay, your turn, Chris.
Well, speaking of that, I certainly never thought I'd hear myself say these words. A 9-year-old student has been suspended for sexually harassing his teacher. You heard me right. A 9-year-old third grade student at Brookside Elementary in North Carolina suspended 2 days from school for sexually harassing his teacher. What sort of heinous sexual act did this boy commit, you might ask? Well, a substitute teacher overheard the child tell another student he thought a certain teacher was cute. What's up with that? Naturally threatened after hearing such graphic language, the substitute teacher immediately reported the incident to school authorities. I'm sure she'll never sub for that school again, and who could blame her? With those 4'5", 70-pound sexual predators lurking around every corner. But seriously, in what way, shape, or form is a 9-year-old telling his friend that a teacher is cute sexual harassment? It's not like the kid was courting the teacher with love notes or coming on to her in the middle of class, or even texting her pictures of himself Brett Favre style. If they suspended him for 2 days because an adult happened to overhear him telling a peer that a teacher was attractive, what would they do if he actually tried to touch her? Cut his hands off? What an inexplicable overreaction to hand this boy anything more than a serious conversation about appropriate behavior. My bet is that the sub was just jealous of the other teacher.
Okay, but to be clear, we don't want to encourage 9-year-old boys to try to touch the teachers, right?
No, absolutely not.
Hold on, why does he need to talk a stern talk about appropriate behavior?
I mean, that's the worst thing he should have been dealt.
For
you know?
Saying a teacher, I gotta say, I mean, this is exactly the kind of stuff that I think is following in the wake of this bully mania that we're getting launched on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think that it would be sexual harassment under any law if a teacher, let's say a male teacher, had told that female substitute teacher that he thought another female teacher was cute. That's sexual harassment?
I don't believe so.
Well, here's an update. The school system launched a full-fledged investigation into the incident, and it was determined no sexual harassment occurred.
And was the kid still suspended?
The kid had already served the suspension.
That's just insane.
Yeah, but the kid probably enjoyed those 2 days off.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And mom probably, you know, treated him to a nice meal out. Mom was very upset, of course.
You know what? He probably had 48 hours of PlayStation.
Exactly.
Oh, sure.
This is certainly going to improve the caliber of his education.
I think this all comes out good. What you know, all's well that ends well.
That's insane. No, this is exactly... And the thing is, people are so intimidated to speak out about some of the problems and the overreach and this anti-bullying agenda that's getting out there, that I think we're going to get all kinds of silliness like this, and the trick's going to be how do you unwind it once you've gone so far.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast, head to edexcellence.net/podcasts to find links and more about this episode. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.